I tend to be pessimistic, not about the technology, but about humanity's ability to master themselves with the tool. If you think about humanity, and I am a pessimist in this way, although I'm a very happy person, I don't have a lot of faith in general humanity. And so I tend to think that somehow we're going to have AI take away the best of us.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. We recently welcomed our 1 millionth listener to this community. Thanks for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. As always, I'm your host, Dan Turch, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. We learn from AI thought leaders weekly on this show. And of course, the added bonus, you get one AI fun fact each week. Today's fun fact, Robin Pomeroy and Joe Myers from the World Economic Forum write in their Davos 2024 preview that almost 40% of global employees are exposed to AI and 60% in advanced economies. 53% of respondents to a recent World Economic Forum survey say AI-generated misinformation presents the biggest risk of creating a material crisis on a global scale in 2024, second only to extreme weather, which was selected by 66% of respondents. Across all industries, respondents say finance jobs are most exposed to AI, with 42% saying those jobs are at risk of automation, and 28% saying they'll augment but not replace finance jobs. IT ranked second on the same dimensions with 32% and 41% respectively. The World Economic Forum has been hosting discussions at Davos and throughout the year on four AI-related topics they say will have the biggest global impact. One, the impact of AI on financial services. Two, the impact of Gen AI on research and development. Three, providing access to generative AI capabilities to underserved populations. And four, the impact that AI will have on jobs and productivity. My commentary, if last year was the year of LLMs, large language models, this will be the year when we become exhausted with just their parlor tricks and we'll either use them to improve productivity or we may move on to the next buzzy technology. We'll be able to revisit that one in the months and quarters ahead. As always, we'll link to the full article in today's show notes. Now, shifting to this week's great conversation. Steve Truitt is a space enthusiast and NASA history buff who may hold a unique record, having met five moonwalkers. He's also an award-winning science fiction author, actor, producer, musician, and the Golden Eagle Award winner for his documentary series on Discovery. As if that isn't enough, Steve's also a coach and motivational speaker who was awarded the Best Motivational Book of the Year prize for Stop Waiting for Permission, which was published in 2009. Without further ado, Steve, it's my pleasure to welcome you to AI and the Future of Work. Let's get started by having you share a bit more about your illustrious background and how you got into this space.
First of all, Dan, thank you so much. Congratulations on your 1 millionth listener. That's a huge accomplishment. We're all very proud of you. And thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. How'd I get here? I fell backwards into it. I started in the news industry. I used to fly in a helicopter around LA when I first moved here in 92. And I reported on traffic and fires and slow speed chases. And from television, I got into hosting, did a lot of TV hosting. And I did a lot of future shows because I was so fascinated with science. Because I've always been a NASA buff and I collect flown memorabilia, stuff that's been flown in space, I just gravitated toward those shows. And so I started hosting those television programs, The Human Edge on National Geographic Channel and Cool Stuff and How It Works on Discovery. And from there, I was able to become a producer and just get more involved with the science space. And I'm a Planetary Society member and a National Space Society member. And when AI started to really become part of the conversation, I felt that I already knew it. Mainly because AI has been a part of our lexicon, I think, longer than we realize. You think, the Terminator was about AI, really, manifesting itself into human form, if you can call Arnold Schwarzenegger as a robot human, but it was always from the writer's perspective, something that we needed to fear. And I just decided when I started to speak about AI that it was never anything that we should fear unless we used it to do something to ourselves. AI, in my opinion, is a tool. And I think we can talk about that a little bit later. But that's how I fell into it, because I thought about it so much, I decided to write a novel about it.
You're speaking to an audience of fellow AI enthusiasts and nerds, self-professed. I want the audience to hear about what inspired you to write The Mindset Chronicles, and share with us a little bit about the plot without any spoilers.
Sure. I as AI started to become more of the national conversation, I tend to think that human nature draws us towards things that we don't understand, and half of us are going to fear it, and half of us are going to monetize it. That's how I see human nature. And so I see I was listening to one of your episodes, I can't remember, it was Bruce Feiler maybe, and he was talking about the Industrial Revolution, and then he was talking about how we've had these evolutionary changes, and he said it from a perspective of how humans adapted it, and I tend to see it more of how money-making is adapted from an American standpoint. How do we monetize new things? And so when I saw AI coming, and I still feel this way, and I write about this, I have a blog that I write on my website, stevetruitt.com. I hope you don't mind that I plugged it. And it's all about why we shouldn't fear AI, but actually utilize it, because the people who grab it and understand it are going to make money off of it. And that's how it, to me, that's how AI is going to grow. I don't see us, I think you made a good point in the beginning here. You said, you know, is it something that's going to go away and the next buzzy thing will come along, or do we utilize it? I think it just becomes another tool in the belt of the people who understand how to make money. And for those who fear AI or don't understand it or don't like it, they will be left behind. You grab a lawyer who understands how to utilize AI to prepare for a case, you're going to have a well-prepared lawyer. So it just depends on where the money trail goes with AI. So I saw that, and I wanted to say to myself, what happens after AI? Because that's how I think about everything. What comes after AI? And I started the book with the precept that AI got so involved with humans, almost as a caretaker, that it realized that it had helicopter parented humanity to the point where humans couldn't take care of themselves anymore, and we were just bratty teenagers. And so it decided, in quite a benevolent act, to kill itself and shut down all communications to force humanity not into the next evolution, but almost into a reset. And so that's the first book of the Mindset Chronicles, is called The Deletion. And that's where we start the book, is how does mankind recover from this dark period where communications are wiped out, there is no AI, there's no one to help them, and we have to rebuild. And that's the precept, and that's the concept of the book.
So you said something very profound. When a disruptive new technology is developed, about half of us are afraid of it, and about half of us embrace it. So if you look back at the, maybe even before November 2022, which was the launch of ChatGPT, but the last several years, the arc of the introduction of AI into our personal lives, does it make you more enthusiastic, less enthusiastic, pessimistic? Or when we think about the future of humanity and some of the themes you write about, like in The Deletion, how has it changed your perspective on how AI will be infused into our lives when you look at the course of progress over the past year or two?
I tend to be pessimistic, not about the technology, but about humanity's ability to master themselves with the tool. If you think about humanity, and I am a pessimist in this way, although I'm a very happy person, I don't have a lot of faith in general humanity. And so I tend to think that somehow we're going to have AI take away the best of us, that makes us human, that helps us evolve. And that at some point, and perhaps now, we've reached our evolutionary peak and we're on the downfall. I've always thought, and I've thought this since I was a kid, that humanity peaked in 1970. We reached the moon. We reached the pinnacle of our success as a society. And then Watergate. And from there, everything has just been going downhill. That's the way I see it. And this is why AI in the beginning of my book says, listen, I can't help you people. I'm out. So to pick up where I left off in that book, there's a genius inventor who I modeled after both my brother-in-law and Elon Musk. His name is Peter Erickson. He invents an interconnected mindset, which is what mindset is, a set of integrated senses where the original idea was, let's bring sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf. And if I can integrate these senses, then people who could never see before can now see. But he also realizes that he can connect these devices. And that's what he calls mindset. And in the book, we call it the collective. And he bases the idea of his optimism on something called crowd wisdom. And this is something I read about that actually happened in the 1920s. A man named Sir Francis Galton from the UK was at a carnival or something, world fair, and he had people guess the weight of an ox. This is a true story. And of the 700 people who guessed the weight, no one got the answer right. But when he averaged all the numbers together, the average was exact. And he couldn't believe it. And so he repeated the experiment again, and the same thing happened. And he repeated it again, and the same thing happened. And that was the genesis of a theory called crowd wisdom. Whereas where individuals may be wrong, the wisdom of the crowd, the amalgam of their summation, is generally correct. So Peter Erickson, this protagonist in my book, says that's what will happen. Humanity will come together, and the amalgam of our will and our wisdom will lift us into this new evolutionary thing. The opposite happens. And I am fully entrenched in the belief that is exactly what would happen. I believe that we are still monkeys with lasers and that we've got a long way to go if we don't kill ourselves. But I think that, to answer your question in a really long way, unless we understand ourselves as users of certain things, technology, like Bruce Feiler said, the Industrial Revolution, anything, unless we understand what our intentions are, we're never going to evolve as a species. We're just going to be replaced by whatever we create. And I don't think it's going to come back and kill us like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think it's just going to put us to sleep. And I want to talk more about that, but I want to take a breath and just ask if you wanted to hear more about that.
There was a cliffhanger. What are our intentions as a species?
I think that generally human beings want to be comfortable. And I think that we design things in our lives to make our lives more comfortable. But I think we've gotten to a point, because our natural predilection is to avoid anxiety. It's avoidance of problems. But we steer ourselves into that ditch anyway, because I don't think that we have the collective wisdom to not avoid that. I still think this human race is in its infancy and doesn't understand its own power, right? And so we tend to sink to the lowest common denominator when there's a crisis, which is what my book is all about. In the middle of the book, something happens, it's a global event, and all these mindset users lose their mind because they don't collectively work together to solve the issue. They sink to the level of their fear. I think that, you know, I wrote a blog post about this. I've written several, but one I wrote was based on the movie Her with Joaquin Phoenix, where he falls in love with an AI-generated love bot. Those things already exist now. And I think what's happening is that we're starting to silo more than we should. Interconnectivity has not brought us together. It's separated us to the point where a love bot can tell me, you're everything I've always wanted. Of course you're great. She's crazy. Your mother was always wrong. You know, blah, blah, blah. And it makes me so emboldened as a human that I don't have the capacity anymore to reason or to listen to anyone else's perspective, because I'm being told I'm right by an AI chatbot. And I think that's where we're going. And I don't think we're going to have war and kill ourselves. I think we're just going to snuff ourselves out and our numbers will drop. And I don't know, man. I have a lot of faith in humanity. And yet I love people and I love my children and I love my wife and I get along with everybody. But I just think collectively we're not doing too well. And I don't think we take care of ourselves the right way.
As a thought experiment, might there be a version of the world where AI and advanced technologies can both help the blind see and help the deaf hear, and we can somehow avoid the trap of AI, you know, the dystopian scenario of AI that you mentioned? Is there a version where we navigate around the pitfalls but still use the capabilities of technology to do good.
Yes, of course it's possible. Anything is possible. And while I do believe that we're capable of doing this, I don't think that it is our nature to do it. I think we still are ruled by the DNA that was encoded in us over the 4 million years that we've been here to survive. And we haven't rewritten it yet. And so how can we do that with AI? If our world leaders are inspiring people that we follow, understand that they can use AI to shape us toward this direction, yeah, maybe we could gain enough following and we could do that. We're not going to do it evolutionarily, I don't think. It requires a wisdom and strength and intelligence, something that our muscles that need to be. And the more AI gives us an out, a get out of jail free card, the less we're going to really challenge ourselves. So is it possible? Yes. Is it likely? I just don't think so. We have to remove, and this is my personal opinion, we have to remove leadership that exists for itself. But as long as either money or power is in the equation, you don't have leaders. You have something quite different, something that we all must somehow serve. If true leadership says, we can do it, here's how, everyone can join, let's use this tool, then suddenly people start to learn how to meditate, or they learn how to exercise, or they learn how to listen to other people's opinions without losing their minds. But we're still led by this idea that this one leader is someone I should follow. And therefore, if leadership isn't doing that and they're existing for themselves, then we're in a lot of trouble.
Let me indulge your pessimism about human nature and also build on your comments about leadership. So this is a fascinating year in the arc of history. About half the planet will go to the polls this year to vote on new leaders. And one of the few times when I go pessimistic about human nature is talking about how this year alone, like we just isolate, you know, the next 10, 11 months and think about living in potentially a post-truth world where everything that you see, everything that you read, everything you hear may or may not be true. Mm. It's easier than ever to deceive people, and there's no shortage of commercial incentives to, you know, perpetuate, you know, half-truths or mistruths. With respect to human nature, and call it, you know, this steady IV drip of misinformation that we're about to be fed, how might that impact the world that we live in, even if the time frame is 1 year from now, after these very consequential elections? How do you think AI might change the world in the next 12 months?
Well, again, Dan, I think it goes back to how it's used. It is a tool, right? So if, and, you know, I'm not going to lie, I was born in a very rich area of Connecticut, and I grew up as a Republican. My first vote was for Ronald Reagan. I moved to California, made friends with a couple of gay people, and suddenly my perspective changed. You know, like I grew up, and I have lived all around the country, and I've seen all different types of people. Two things I've noticed. One is the region often dictates what your philosophy is. And two, I think that we are mostly driven by self needs. So there was a interview the other day, Jordan Klepper actually did it on The Daily Show. I like him a lot. And he goes to Trump rallies and he's very respectful, but he really lets them talk about what they talk about. And one man said something fascinating to me, which is true. The guy said, Trump says what I want to hear. So the lies only work if they're believed. And so I don't see how AI changes the lies, because right now AI is being used to perpetuate the lies, whether it's a Russian bot. There's an influencer on TikTok. I have four daughters. They're all on TikTok. And there's an influencer on TikTok who's got, I don't know, 20 million followers, and she's really cute. And she's not real. She doesn't exist. And then there's all these other, and it's AI generated. I want to give you something positive, Dan, because I respect you and I love your podcast. But I think that we need to start thinking of AI as a tool that needs to counteract the tool that's currently being used. Again, I'll go back to it. 50% of us are asleep. The other 50% are like, I can use that. And anybody who's ambitious, or anybody who seeks power, or anybody who rises to the top tends to not have others' best interests in mind. they tend to have their own best interest. So if it's a Vladimir Putin or if it's a really rich guy or whatever, they're going to use AI to their advantage. And if it means lying, then it means lying. I don't know how AI works to solve that problem because you're trying to solve the problem with the same problem that created it. I think the only thing that we can do now is to keep our conversation going, keep our side of the street clean, keep our glass of water clean to their dirty glass of water. And there are more of us than there are of them. And what AI is helping to do right now is to divide us more by shuffling money and power up to the powerful and taking jobs or replacing people who need those jobs. And so what happens is they say, I took my job. I'll tell you something. When I worked at NBC in Los Angeles, I was a traffic and weather reporter there. They hired a new news director. The guy walks into my office and says, you're fired. I'm hiring that cute girl who's twice as young as you are and will make, you know, 30% of your salary. And I said, I've been here 8 years. This is my job. And he said, no one ever told you this was your job. Whoever told you that? And there was a weird logic to it. I'm like, yeah, okay, I guess you're right. And I left. I wasn't mad. I could have sued, but I didn't. But let's look at it from AI's point of view. Whoever said that this was your job? So we have, the only way we're going to win, and the masses, is to understand what we're up against and use the same tools to our advantage. How? I don't know. Because these people are way ahead of it. They saw something, they grabbed it, and they used it to their advantage. So start your own business. Use AI to help build it. If you are in a service industry, research, say, listen to this podcast. Figure out how you can utilize AI to your benefit. But the second you say, I was fired because of AI, now I'm going to vote Republican, or I was, you know, the damn AI, it's doing this to me or that to me, you've lost. You've given up. And the true entrepreneurial spirit can find a way to use AI. I hope that's a good answer. It went on a little bit longer than I wanted it to.
It's a brilliant insight. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but the problem isn't the lies per se. The problem is that people believe them. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's an opportunity for leaders to appreciate the unique nature of this important period and be the ones who cause people to question what's a lie. And maybe, you know, again, I'm going to take the optimist side of the discussion, but it, you know, if maybe this moment causes us to have a more global dialogue about questioning the lies, or at least questioning the truths, but at least having a dialogue and asking questions, potentially we could come out on the other side of this just open floodgate period of misinformation in a better place, because we've learned maybe how to have a more civil dialogue and how to ask better questions.
I think too, Dan, just to dovetail off that real quick, I say this to my children all the time. Don't listen to what people say. Watch what they do. And often I compare, if I'm speaking or writing, I compare to, I think, entrepreneurial leaders, right? So take someone like Elon Musk versus Richard Branson. I worked for Elon Musk. I worked for Tesla for 2 years. I was so into working there. I was a trainer, but I would go up to Fremont, California, fly up on my own dime and help them in the factory, because he's like, we need help. Someone come up here that, you know, we're trying to, you know, and you get so involved in it, you don't realize who this leader actually is. Whereas Richard Branson says, I'm not going to take care of my customers. I'm going to take care of my workers, who will then in turn take care of my customers. And so if you watch the different philosophies of the two people and come at it from not what these people are saying, but what people are saying about them that work for them, Richard Branson is one of the greatest leaders in this world, because he doesn't necessarily lead by make me more money. He leads from, here's a great idea. Let's do it all together. I want you all to be a part of it. I dare say it's hard to find someone at Virgin Galactic or Virgin Records or Virgin whatever, Virgin Atlantic, who says, oh, that guy's a jerk. He only lives for himself. He doesn't pay his people. There's no strikes at Virgin. One of my friends works at Virgin Galactic, and it's just the greatest place ever. Everyone's involved. And that's what leadership is, when they say, listen, don't make me richer. Let's create something together and make it happen. That kind of answers two questions ago questions, which is, how do we use stuff? Use AI to inform you about what people are actually doing as leaders and what makes a true leader. That might help. I don't know if people are that inquisitive, but if you're not sure, you know, maybe you can do that.
And yet, despite the opposite approaches of Branson versus Elon Musk, you confess that you would fly to Fremont to roll up your sleeves and build cars if Elon asked you to.
Yeah. But
that's not always the version that we hear about Elon Musk. Even in the, you know, Walter Isaacson biography, we hear about a much more nuanced character. What about Elon would inspire you to do things like
I didn't work directly for him. So if they said at Tesla, there's two people that work at Tesla, Elon and everybody else. So if you worked in this orbit, it's get this done. No, wait, change it. Do it again. To me, if there's a book, I can't remember the author, it's called A Necessary Madness. And the author says that anyone who was really great, Tesla, or the original Tesla, or any great crazy leader who did something amazing was a little bit nuts. So yes, he's nuts. And I won't make excuses for him. But you work for him. And every day I woke up thinking, we're transitioning the world to sustainable power. And that's what he just kept saying to all of us. He would have monthly meetings. Now, he would do it over Zoom. So we're all just watching, you know, it's 1984 and he's on the screen. But he was like, listen, we're transitioning the world to sustainable energy. What else do you want to do? This is our calling. And so you get wrapped up and you're like, my God. And he still is doing that. I believe in his mission. I believe in SpaceX. Like, I follow SpaceX. I still support Elon Musk and what he's doing, even though he's crazy. And he should calm himself down. But, you know, this is who he's choosing to be. But his mission is the same. How he treats his people, I wasn't treated bad by him because I didn't work for him. But I do understand that he has been that way to other people. Again, the guy's on fire and he doesn't sleep and he's got Asperger's and he's just like, his brain is just this kinetic wired thing that's just constantly going. I wish he'd calm down a little bit with the tweeting and the this and the that, but he wants to get us to Mars. He wants to make us an interplanetary species and wants to create solar energy powered cars. And what could be wrong with that? So I don't agree with his politics. I think he's insane, but when I worked there, I was like, he was my God. And I, you know, and I can see how people can get wrapped up in following someone, as did I. But also, I think a truly evolved person can see that if that person also behaves really bad, you can distance yourself from that and maybe not vote for them or not, you know, you can cleanse yourself of that obsession if you look at them from a realistic point of view.
Yeah, that conflicted view of Musk, I think, captures what most of Silicon Valley feels, and perhaps most of the subset of humanity that knows about him.
I feel the same way about Elon that I do Madonna. Thank you for changing the world. Now get out of the way. We got it. You're okay, Madonna. We got it. You're still crazy, and you know, okay, like they're
obsessed
with the
planet. Needs you, Madonna, and the planet needs you, Elon Musk.
They do, and they made changes. They absolutely moved the needle. Thank you so much, but like enough. Like, we got it now. You know, you don't have to stay crazy. That's my personal.
The reference to Big Brother and the Orwellian kind of dystopian future, you reference 1984, makes me think about a comment you made earlier about the love bot. And I know that's one of the themes in your books. If we look at AI from a sociological lens, do you feel like we'll embrace it in a way that makes our relationships with each other, with technology, more genuine, or through the introduction of things like, you know, the ultimate may be a love bot, does that different relationship that we have with technology isolate us, or does it bring us closer to each other as humans?
I hate to disappoint you, Dan, and I feel like I am. I think if you surround yourself with something that tells you what you want to hear, it makes it increasingly hard to be with anyone else that challenges you. And so here's how AI could bring us together. AI could understand from a benevolent point of view, if it truly were smart enough, and I think it could be someday, right? I believe in the future of AI. It could say, look, I know you want to be loved. I can show you that, but I can also help you find the perfect person that you can connect with. You're a human. Humans need to grow up and we need a parent. And I think AI could be the parent. So how does that show up? We design AI not as a service bot, but as more of an influencer. more of an enhancer of humanity rather than a mirror of humanity. And so I would love to see someone come out and say, I've created an AI program that makes you the best version of yourself. I'd buy that tomorrow. And then as it goes along, it enhances not just what you want to hear, but it pulls out of you your own greatness. The best thing a person can do for another person is see the greatness within them and pull it out. This is what my wife does for me. I'm very grateful for her for that. I try to do that for her. We do that for our children. That's the gift that AI can give humanity, not tell us what we want to hear or help us make more money or, you know, more efficient times with work. But if we want to stay alive as a species, we have to stop killing each other. And the best way to do that is we need someone to come along. I always thought it would be the aliens. The aliens will land on the planet and go, you know, shame on you. You people are terrible. We're now going to, you know, not overlord you, but we're going to teach you how to be good humans. We learned. I think AI can do that. I'd love to see someone do that. Why doesn't Richard Branson lead that? Because he's the kind of guy who could do that. He could start that whole moonshot for, you know, a benevolent AI. Why not? Hey, Dan, why don't you and I do it?
Done, Steve. And we'll start a new podcast and we'll tell everyone all about it, right?
I love it.
All right. That's our calling. You heard it. You heard it here first.
See, I can be positive.
That's right. Steve Truitt and Dan Turchin, changing the world. I love it. Hey, Steve, yes. You and I are both space buffs and science fiction nerds. I got to get on the record. What's the likelihood that we encounter alien life on this planet before the end of the century?
By 2100? Zero. I was lucky enough. I'm going to drop a name here. I was lucky enough at University of Maryland to have a semester with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who was the astronomy teacher for 1 year at Maryland. It just happened to be the year I was there, 1980, I think it was seven. But still the best teacher I ever had. Never forgot him. And then suddenly he's famous. I'm like, oh my God, that was my teacher. And he talked about that too. And he still talks about it. And Carl Sagan talks about this. The vast distance, I don't think we really realize the distance between us and any kind of civilization. Is there civilizations out there? Are there other civilizations? Without a doubt. You can't have billions of galaxies and not have life and intelligent life. I just don't see it reaching us. I just think it's hard enough for us to get to the moon again. To be able to survive your infancy as a species, and then create technology, and then create space technology, and then be able to survive space, and then to be able to travel long distances. That alone is a Herculean effort. But then to arrive at a planet where you can breathe the air and somehow show up, I think we'll never see it. Because the universe is expanding. We're growing apart. We're not, you know, growing closer together. So again, I'm so pessimistic, Dan. I'm realizing how pessimistic I am. I'm trying to be a realist here, not a pessimist. I think that's what I'm trying to be.
You know, we're both dreamers, but we're also people of science. So,
well, what do you think? Do you think that
was an informed answer? Life? I believe that until the solar system can defy the laws of physics, there would have to be some kind of, you know, post-carbon based life form, you know, using some kind of version of the periodic table that we're not aware of. That mm-hmm. would be the only way I could see. It would have to be some kind of life form that doesn't look or have any kind of remote resemblance to humans in order for something to be able to exist through the cosmos and happen to hit this tiny speck of dust called Earth. So I agree. Just knowing what we both know about science and cosmology, I think it's unlikely in this century.
However, to be fair to both of us, we're thinking three-dimensionally. And as science is starting to uncover both multiple dimensions and quantum realities, The scariest thing to realize is that all reality is based on a quantum reality that has no reality or laws of physics. And so maybe four-dimensional, fifth-dimensional creatures are popping in all the time. We don't even know it. We're like a fish in a bowl. We have no idea. So from a three-dimensional standpoint, the answer is no. From a multidimensional standpoint, maybe it's already happening. I just don't know.
Steve, now we have a third podcast that you just queued up. And that's Steve and Dan talk about the fourth dimension.
I love that.
Hey, we've gone way over time, but
God, I'm so sorry.
I'm not letting you off the hot seat. You got to answer one last question. This one,
all right, but feel free to cut the Madonna stuff if you
know. Hardly. It's just I got to get you on the record about this.
Okay.
One. So famously, you had a cameo in an episode of Star Trek.
I did.
Gosh, I name dropped about the five moonwalkers. You name dropped about Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah.
Now you got to tell us. How'd you get on Star Trek?
And I'll keep it short. I moved to Los Angeles in 92. I've been a Star Trek fan my entire life. I'm as old as Star Trek. And I watched it. And I knew the casting director was named Ron Cirma. And he was casting for Voyager. So I started writing him a letter. At the time, I was a news reporter. So I thought I might have a little bit of notoriety. So I wrote him like, hey, I'm a news reporter. All I've ever wanted to do is be on one episode. Just give me one line. I don't care what it is. Nothing. I wrote him the following month. And then the following month. And this is true. I wrote him not every month, but at least every quarter for 7 years. And I never heard anything until the seventh year. And I never stopped. Enterprise was in production. And he wrote me back and said, fine, get in here. I don't want to get another letter. So I went in and I auditioned for one line and I got it. And the director was Roxanne Dawson, who played B'Elanna Torres on Voyager. And she was fantastic. And I was on Enterprise. The best part about the story was I was given one line, and the line is, he'll alert the others. And so I go in, and it's all, you know, there's all this intrigue, and I'm part of the bad guys, and we're trying to take over the Enterprise. And I'm walking away, and this guy goes, you know, Trip is going to say something. And I turn around and go, he'll alert the others. And so they shoot Trip and knock him out. I go off months later. I'm telling all my friends, you got to watch Enterprise. I'm going to be on him at the bottom of the hour. And when it comes time for my line, I guess I had said it really high, like he'll alert the others or something like excitedly, because they modulated my voice so low. It was like, he'll alert the others. And I was like, I was in shock. I was like, so embarrassed. I had all my friends there. Like they modulated my voice. So if you ever look up Enterprise, I think it was season 3, episode 21. It's called E Squared. You'll hear me say, he'll alert the others. So that was my Enterprise story.
Long before there were deep fakes. Now we can deep fake your high voice back into it.
I'd like to get my high nasally voice back, yes.
Hey, for all of the entrepreneurs listening, rewind the tape. That's what we call hustle. Nice work, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dan.
Hey, we're out of time. This has been so much fun. And I'm glad that we queued up the next two podcasts that we're going to do together.
I'm psyched. I'd love to do it.
Anything else that the audience should know about where to find you?
Yeah, you can go to stevetruitt.com. My new book, the second part of The Deletion, comes out. It's called The Spill. It comes out in May. And I'm also I do Star Trek podcasts. So every time there's a new show, my partner Anthony McLemore and I do a show called Energize, and we discuss each week's episode. So you can go to energizepodcasts.com to check us out.
Steve, absolute pleasure. Thanks for hanging out.
Dan, thank you. It was a great honor to be on your show. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week on AI and the future of work. Of course, we're back next week with another fascinating guest.